Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke, first published in 1790. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Second one-third of Part 3. Cement 1. Paper Money. The many new republics of France don't have in their nature and constitution anything to make them cohere with one another. So what cement have the legislators provided for them from extraneous materials? I take no notice of their confederations, their spectacles, their civic feasts, and their fanatical excitement. Those are mere tricks. But tracing their policy through their actions, I think I can pick out the arrangements by which they propose to hold these republics together. The first is the confiscation, with the accompanying paper currency. The second is the supreme power of the city of Paris. The third is the general army of the state. I cannot deny that the operation of the confiscation and the paper currency, one depending on the other, may for a while constitute some sort of cement. But if eventually the confiscation turns out not to be sufficient to support the paper currency, as I am morally certain it will not, then instead of cementing these confederate republics together, it will add infinitely to their dissociation, distraction, and confusion. And if the confiscation sinks the paper currency, the cement is gone with the circulation. In the meantime, its binding force will be uncertain, tightening or loosening with every variation in the credit of the paper. The only thing that is certain in this scheme is its effect in producing an oligarchy in every one of the republics. A paper circulation not backed by any real money, deposited or promised, amounting now to £44 million of English money, and compulsorily substituted for the coin of the kingdom, becomes the substance of the state's revenue, as well as the medium of all its commercial and civil business. This must put into the hands of the managers and conductors of this circulation the whole of whatever power, authority, and influence is left. But this is not merely a money concern. There is also the process of drawing out portions of the confiscated lands for sale, continually changing paper into land and land into paper. Through this process, the spirit of money-jobbing and speculation goes into the mass of land itself and incorporates with it. By this kind of operation, that sort of property becomes unnaturally and monstrously active, throwing into the hands of the various managers all the money, and perhaps a full 10% of all the land in France, which now has the worst fault of a paper currency, namely great uncertainty in its value. The new dealers, being adventurers without any fixed habits or local biases, will purchase so as to resell, as the market of paper or of money or of land presents an advantage. A holy bishop thinks that agriculture will derive great advantages from the enlightened usurers who are to purchase the church confiscations. Well, I am an old farmer, if not a good one, and with great humility I beg leave to tell his former lordship that usury is not a tutor to agriculture. And if the word enlightened is understood according to the new dictionary, as it always is in your new schools, I cannot conceive how a man's not believing in God can teach him to cultivate the earth with the slightest additional skill or encouragement. One old, experienced peasant is worth all the directors of the two academies and the directors of the central bank, and I have learned more about a curious and interesting branch of husbandry in one short conversation with an old Carthusian monk than from all the bank directors I ever talked with. But there is no danger of money dealers meddling with rural economy. At first their imaginations may be captivated by the innocent and unprofitable delights of a pastoral life, but they will soon find that agriculture is a more laborious and less lucrative trade than the one they had left. After singing its praises, they will turn their backs on it. They will farm the money value of the church's land with much more profit than comes from farming its vineyards and its cornfields. They will employ their talents according to their habits and their interests. They will not follow the plough while they can direct treasuries and govern provinces. A nation of gamblers. Your legislators, in everything new, are the first to base a commonwealth on gambling, infusing the spirit into it as though it were its vital breath. Their aim is to change France from a great kingdom into a great play table, to turn its inhabitants into a nation of gamblers, to make speculation as extensive as life, to mix it with all its concerns, and to divert the whole of the hopes and fears of the people from their usual channels into the impulses, passions, and superstitions of those who live on chances. They loudly proclaim that their present system of a republic cannot possibly exist without this kind of gambling fund, and that the very thread of its life is spun out of the raw materials of these speculations. The old gambling and funds was harmful enough, undoubtedly, though only to individuals. But where the law openly forces the people to this destructive table by bringing the spirit and symbols of gambling into the minutest matters, and engaging everybody in it, this causes the most dreadful epidemic of that kind that the world has ever seen. In France, a man can neither earn nor buy his dinner without a speculation. What he receives in the morning will not have the same value at night. What he is compelled to take as payment for an old debt will not be received as the same when he comes to pay a debt contracted by himself, or tries by prompt payment to avoid contracting any debt at all. Industry must wither away. Careful provision will have no existence in your country. Who will labour without knowing the amount of his pay? Who will study to increase what no one can estimate? Who will accumulate when he does not know the value of what he saves? If it weren't for its uses in gambling, accumulating your paper wealth would be not the prudence of a man, but the crazy instinct of a jackdaw. The truly melancholy part of the policy of systematically making a nation of gamblers is this: all are forced to play, but few can understand the game, and fewer still are in a position to make use of the knowledge. The many must be the dupes of the few, who conduct the machine of these speculations. What effect it must have on rural people is visible. The townsman can calculate from day to day, not so the inhabitant of the country. When the peasant first brings his corn to market, the magistrate in the towns obliges him to take at par the promissory note issued by the government. When he goes to the shop with his money, he finds it's 7%, the worse for crossing the street. He will not readily go to this market again. The townspeople will be inflamed. They will force the country people to bring their corn. Resistance will begin, and the murders of Paris and St. Denis may be renewed through all France. In your theory of representation, the countryside is perhaps given more than its share. What does this empty compliment signify? Where have you placed the real power over moneyed and landed circulation? Where have you placed the means of raising and lowering the value of every man's freehold? Those whose operations can take from or add to the possessions of every man in France must be the masters of every man in France. The whole of the power obtained by this revolution will settle in the towns among the burghers and the moneyed directors who lead them. The landed gentleman, the yeoman, the peasant, none of these have habits or inclinations or experience that can lead them to any share in this, the only remaining source of power and influence in France. The very nature of a country life, the very nature of landed property, in all the occupations and pleasures they provide, makes it impossible for country people to combine and organize which is the only way of getting and exerting influence. However hard and skilfully you work to combine them, these folk are always dissolving into individuality. Anything in the nature of incorporation is almost impracticable among them. Hope, fear, alarm, jealousy, ephemeral rumours, these are the reins and spurs by which leaders check or urge the minds of followers, and they are not easily employed among scattered people. They cannot proceed systematically. If the country gentlemen attempt an influence through the mere income of their property, what can they do against those who have 10 times their income and can ruin their property by defeating it at the market? If the landed man takes out a mortgage, he lowers the value of his land and raises the value of promissory notes. He increases his enemy's power by the very means he must take to contend with him. So the country gentleman, the man of liberal views and habits, attached to no profession, will be as completely excluded from the government of his country as if he were an outlaw. It is obvious that in the towns all the things that conspire against the country gentleman combine in favour of the money manager and director. In towns it is natural for people to combine. The habits of burghers, their occupations, their diversions, their business, their idleness continually bring them into mutual contact. Their virtues and their vices are sociable. They are always on duty. And they come embodied and half-disciplined into the hands of those who plan to use them for civil or military action. I conclude that if this monster of a constitution continues, France will be wholly governed by the agitators in corporations, by societies in the towns formed of directors of promissory notes, and trustees for the sale of church lands, attorneys, agents, money-jobbers, speculators, and adventurers, composing an ignoble oligarchy based on the destruction of the crown, the church, the nobility, and the people. Here end all the deceitful dreams and visions of the equality and rights of men. Those are all absorbed, sunk, and lost forever in the bottomless bog of this base oligarchy. One might be tempted to think that France must have been guilty of some great offences, for which heaven is punishing it by subjecting it to a vile and inglorious domination. I confess to feeling sorrow, mixed with some indignation, at the conduct of a few men, once of great rank and still of great character, who have engaged in a business too deep for the lead line of their understanding to fathom, who have allowed their fair reputation and the authority of their titles to further the designs of men with whom they could not be acquainted, and have thereby made their very virtues operate to the ruin of their country. So much for the first cementing principle. Cement 2. The power of Paris. The second material of cement for their new republic is the superiority of the city of Paris. It is in this part of the project that we must look for the cause of the destruction of all the old boundaries of provinces and jurisdictions, ecclesiastical and secular, and the dissolution of all ancient combinations of things, as well as the formation of so many small, unconnected republics. The power of the city of Paris is evidently one great spring of all their politics. It is through the power of Paris that the leaders of this faction command the whole legislative and the whole executive government. Paris has enormous strength, vastly greater than that of any of the square republics, and this strength is collected and condensed within a small area. Paris has a natural and easy connection among its parts, which will not be affected by any scheme of a geometrical constitution, and it does not matter much whether its proportion of representation is more or less, because it has the whole draught of fishes in its dragnet, that is, in the National Assembly. The other divisions of the kingdom, being hacked and torn to pieces and separated from all their habitual means and principles of union, cannot in the meantime unite against Paris. Nothing was to be left in all the subordinate divisions but weakness, disconnection, and confusion. To confirm this part of the plan, the Assembly has recently resolved that no two of their republics shall have the same commander-in-chief. To a person who takes a view of the whole, this strength of Paris's will appear to be a system of general weakness. It is boasted that a geometrical policy has been adopted, that all local ideas should be sunk, and that the people should no longer be Gascons, Picards, Bretons, Normans, but Frenchmen, with one country, one heart, and one assembly. But instead of being all Frenchmen, the inhabitants of that region are more likely, soon, not to have any country. No man was ever attached by a sense of pride, partiality, or real affection to a kind of square measurement. He never will glory in belonging to Checker No. 71, or to any other badge ticket. We begin our public affections in our families. We pass on to our neighbourhoods and our habitual provincial connections. These are inns and resting places. The divisions of our country that have been formed by habit, and not by a sudden jerk of authority, were little images of the country as a whole. Love for the whole is not extinguished by the subordinate partiality. Perhaps it is a sort of elemental training for those higher and broader concerns that men come to have for the prosperity of a kingdom as extensive as France. Citizens caring about that general territory itself, as about former provinces, comes from old prejudices and unreasoned habits, and not from the geometric properties of its shape. Passing from the civil creating and civil cementing principles of this constitution to the National Assembly, which is to appear and act as sovereign, we see a body in its constitution with every possible power and no possible external control. We see a body that has no fundamental laws, no established maxims, no respected rules of proceeding, a body that nothing can keep firm to any system whatsoever. Your all-sufficient legislators, in their hurry to do everything at once, have forgotten one thing that seems essential, and which I believe has never before been omitted, in theory or in practice, by any projector of a republic. They have forgotten to constitute a senate, or something of that nature and character. Never before this time was heard of a body politic composed of one legislative and active assembly, and its executive officers, without such a council, without something to which foreign states might connect themselves, something the people could look up to, something which might give steadiness and preserve something like consistency in the proceedings of state. Kings generally have such a body as a council. A monarchy may exist without it, but it seems to be in the very essence of a republican government. It holds a sort of middle place between the supreme power exercised by the people, or immediately delegated from them, and the mere executive. Of this there are no traces in your constitution, and in providing nothing of this kind, your republic founders have revealed their utter incompetence. Forming an executive power. So much for the constitution of the legislature. Let us now see what they have done toward the formation of an executive power. For this they have chosen a downgraded king. This first executive officer of theirs is to be a machine, without any sort of deliberative discretion in any of his official acts. At best he is only a channel, to convey to the National Assembly such facts as that body may need to know. If he had been made the exclusive channel, that role would have had some importance, though it would have been infinitely perilous to those who chose to play it. But public intelligence and statements of facts can reach the Assembly with equal authenticity by any other route. So the King's office of providing intelligence is insignificant. I shall consider the French scheme of an executive officer in its two natural divisions, civil and political. According to the new constitution, the higher parts of judicature do not rest with the King. The King of France is not the fountain of justice. he does not nominate either the lower court or the appellate judges, and cannot veto any choice of them that is made. He is not even the public prosecutor. He serves only as a notary to authenticate the choice made of the judges in the several districts. By his officers he is to carry out their sentence. When we look into the true nature of his authority, he appears to be nothing more than a chief of debt collectors, sergeants at arms, tax collectors, jailers, and hangmen. It is impossible to place anything called royalty in a more degrading position. It would have been 1,000 times better for the dignity of this unhappy prince if he had nothing at all to do with the administration of justice, given that he is deprived of all that is venerable and all that is consolatory in that function, without power of originating any process, without a power of suspension, mitigation, or pardon. Everything in justice that is vile and odious is thrown upon him. It would be unnatural for him, situated as he now is, to respect himself or to be respected by others. Now, consider this new executive officer in respect of his political capacity, as he acts under the orders of the National Assembly. To apply laws is a royal office. To carry out orders is not to be a king. Still, a political executive magistracy, even if it is nothing but that, is a great trust. It is a trust indeed that has much depending on its faithful and diligent performance, both in the person presiding in it and in all his subordinates. It ought to be supplied with dignity, authority, and consideration, and it ought to lead to glory. How can a king command executive service when he has no means to reward it? Not in a permanent office, not in a grant of land, not even in a pension of £50 a year, or the vainest and most trivial title. In France, the king is no more the fountain of honour than he is the fountain of justice. All rewards, all distinctions, are in other hands. Those who serve the king can be driven by no natural motive except fear, by a fear of everything except their master. His functions of internal coercion are as odious as the ones he exercises in the Department of Justice. If relief is to be given to any municipality, the Assembly gives it. If troops are to be sent to make them obedient to the Assembly, the king has to carry out the order, and on each occasion he is spattered with the blood of his people. His name and authority are used to enforce every harsh decree. He must even concur in the butchery of anyone who tries to free him from his imprisonment, or show the slightest attachment to his person or to his former authority. A king, in circumstances like those of the present King of France, if his misfortunes have so stupefied him that he is satisfied to eat and sleep without any regard to glory, can never be fit for the office of king. If he feels as men commonly feel, he must be aware that an office in such circumstances can bring him no fame or reputation. He has no warm-hearted interest that can arouse him to action. At best, his conduct will be passive and defensive. To inferior people, such an office might be a matter of honour. But being raised to it is different from descending to it, and suggests different sentiments. If he really names the ministers, they will have a sympathy with him. If they are forced on him, the whole business between them and the nominal king will be mutual counteraction. In all other countries, the office of ministers of state is of the highest dignity. In France, it is full of peril and incapable of glory. Yet ministers in France will have rivals, while the desire for a miserable salary is an incentive to short-sighted avarice. Your constitution enables those competitors of the ministers to attack them in their vital parts, while they have no means of repelling their charges except in the degrading character of culprits. The ministers of state in France are the only persons in that country who cannot have a share in the national councils. But they are responsible, you may say. Responsibility prevents crimes and makes attempts against the laws dangerous. but only idiots could think of responsibility as a driver of active and zealous service. Is the conduct of a war to be entrusted to a man who may abhor its principle, whose every step to make it successful confirms the power of those by whom he is oppressed? Will foreign states seriously enter into negotiations with someone who has no prerogative of peace or war? I know it will be said that these feelings and attitudes in the court and executive government will continue only through this generation, and that the king has been brought to declare that his oldest son will be educated in conformity to his situation. If he is made to conform to his situation, he will have no education at all. His training will be even worse than that of an arbitrary monarch. If he reads, some good or evil genius will tell him his ancestors were kings, and from then on his objective must be to assert himself and to avenge his parents. This, you will say, is not his duty. That may be, but it is nature. And while you turn nature against you, it is not wise of you to trust to duty. Your state now nurses in its bosom a source of weakness, perplexity, counteraction, inefficiency, and decay, and it prepares the means of its final ruin. You have settled, by an economy as perverted as the policy, two establishments of government, one real, one fictitious. Both maintained at vast expense, the cost of the fictitious one being greater, I think. Such a machine as the latter is not worth the grease of its wheels. The expense is exorbitant, and neither the show nor the use deserve a tenth part of the cost. You may say, "Oh, but you don't do justice to the talents of the legislators. You don't allow, as you should, for necessity. Their scheme of executive force was not their choice. This pageant must be kept. The people would not consent to part with it." Right, I understand you. In spite of your grand theories that you want to make heaven and earth bend to, you do know how to conform yourselves to the nature and circumstances of things. But when you were obliged to conform thus far to circumstances, you ought to have carried your submission further, and to have made a proper instrument that would be useful for its purposes. That was in your power. For instance, among many other options, it was in your power to leave to your king the right of peace and war. This prerogative ought to be trusted to your king only if he also enjoyed other auxiliary trusts, which he does not now have. But if he did possess them, dangerous as they undoubtedly are, the advantages of such a constitution would more than compensate for the risk. There is no other way of keeping the various potentates of Europe from intriguing, separately and personally, with the members of your assembly, meddling in all your concerns, and fomenting in the heart of your country the most pernicious of all factions, ones directed by foreign powers in their interests. I hear that the persons called ministers have signified an intention of resigning their places. I am astonished that they did not resign long ago. The situation they have been in for the past year is one I wouldn't have stood in for all the world. I assume they wished well to the revolution, but they were placed on a height from which, humiliating though it was, they must have seen the evils that have been produced by that revolution. In every step they took, they must have felt the degraded situation of their country and their utter inability to serve it. They are in a kind of subordinate servitude that has no precedent in history. Without confidence from their sovereign, on whom they were forced, or from the assembly, who forced them on him, all the noble functions of their office are performed by committees of the assembly, without any regard for their personal or their official authority. They are to act without power, to be responsible without discretion, to deliberate without choice. The abolition of the regional courts of appeal. I can see as little genius and talent in the National Assembly's plan of judicature as I see in its other plans. the framers of your constitution began by utterly abolishing the regional courts. These venerable bodies, like the rest of the old government, needed to be reformed, whether or not there was any change in the monarchy. But many features of their constitution deserved approval. They had one fundamental excellence: they were independent. The most doubtful feature of their office, namely its being something that could be bought and sold, contributed to this independence of character. They held for life. Indeed, they may be said to have held by inheritance. Appointed by the monarch, they were considered as nearly out of his power. The monarch's most determined exertions against them only showed their radical independence. They were permanent political bodies, constituted to resist arbitrary innovation. And from that corporate constitution, and from most of their forms, they were fit to provide certainty and stability to the laws. They were a safe asylum to secure these laws in all the ups and downs of mood and opinion. They saved that sacred deposit of the country, its laws, during the reigns of arbitrary princes and the struggles of arbitrary factions. They kept alive the memory and record of the Constitution. They were the great security to private property. The supreme power in a state ought to have, as far as possible, its judicial authority so constituted as not only to depend on that power, but in some way to balance it. These courts had provided some corrective to the monarchy's excesses and vices. Such an independent judicature was much more necessary when a democracy became the absolute power of the country. In that constitution, what you have contrived, elective, temporary, local judges, exercising their dependent functions in a narrow society, is the worst of all tribunals. It will be vain to look to them for any appearance of justice toward strangers, toward the obnoxious rich, toward all those who in the election have supported unsuccessful candidates. It will be impossible to keep the new tribunals clear of the worst spirit of faction. If the regional courts had been preserved, instead of being dissolved at such a ruinous cost to the nation, they could have served in this new commonwealth in roughly the same way that the court and senate of Areopagus served in Athens, namely as one of the balances and correctives to the evils of a light and unjust democracy. Everyone knows that this tribunal was the great stay of that state. Everyone knows how carefully it was upheld, and with what a religious awe it was consecrated. The regional courts in France were not wholly free from faction, I admit. But this evil was exterior and accidental, not an inevitable result of their constitution, which is what it must be in your new contrivance of elected tribunals with 6-year terms. Several English writers commend the abolition of the old tribunals, supposing that they determined everything by bribery and corruption. But they have stood the test of monarchic and republican scrutiny. The royal court wanted to prove them to be corrupt when they were dissolved in 1771. Those who have again dissolved them, after their reinstatement a few years later, would have proved them to be corrupt if they could. But both inquisitions have failed. I conclude that gross monetary corruption must have been rare among them. It would have been prudent, along with preserving the regional courts, to preserve their former power of critical commentary on all the decrees of the National Assembly, as they did on those that passed during the monarchy. This would be a means of squaring the occasional decrees of a democracy to some principles of general jurisprudence. The vice of the ancient democracies, and one cause of their ruin, was that they, like you, ruled by occasional decrees. This practice soon broke in on the tenor and consistency of the laws. It lessened the people's respect for them, and totally destroyed them in the end. The judicature. Instead of imitating your monarchy, and seating your judges on a bench of independence, you aim to reduce them to the most blind obedience. You first appoint judges who, I suppose, are to determine according to law. And then you let them know that you will eventually give them some laws by which to determine. Any studies they have made, if they have made any, will be useless to them, but they are to be sworn to obey all the rules, orders, and instructions they receive from the National Assembly. If they submit to these, they leave the subject with no way of appealing to the law. They become complete and most dangerous instruments in the hands of the governing power, which can wholly change the rules in preparation for a case or in the middle of one. If these orders of the National Assembly come to be contrary to the will of the people, who locally choose judges, dreadful confusion must result. For the judges owe their places to the local authority, and the commands they are sworn to obey come from those who have no share in their appointment. The Assembly promises to create a body of law that will be short, simple, clear, and so forth. That is, by their short laws they will leave much to the discretion of the judge, while they have exploded the authority of all the learning which could make judicial discretion, a perilous thing at best, deserve to count as sound discretion. Oddly, the administrative bodies are carefully exempted from the jurisdiction of these new tribunals. That is, the persons who ought to be the most entirely submitted to the laws are exempted from their power. The cause of the exemption is plain. These administrative bodies are the great instruments of the present leaders in their march through democracy to oligarchy. So they must be put above the law. End of the second one-third of part 3.